listening to On the Couch with Carly. Carly's couch is a safe space to talk. I'm a psychologist, but I'm not your pipe-smoking, tweed-wearing stereotype.
Hello, and welcome back to On the Couch with Carly. Today, I have a special guest. Today, on the couch is Sindiso Nyoni. Sindiso is a friend of mine and someone I've known for over a decade. But I also follow his work and have followed his parenting journey. And so today we're going to have an in-depth discussion about fatherhood, which is, as you know, a passion of mine at the moment to talk about on the pod. But before we go on and I'll get Sindiso to speak from his own experience, I just want to introduce him and tell you a little bit about who he is in the world and how what he does. So Sindiso is from Bulawayo in Zimbabwe. He is a self-developed graphic artist who's been described as a contemporary illustrator, activist, street artist, and multidisciplinary graphic designer. He studied in Johannesburg. He did a BTech degree in graphic design and has worked as an illustrator and art director in the advertising industry, also known as Riot. His work has been published locally, exhibited at international biennial poster exhibitions, and he has collaborated with on projects which have won a Cannes Lion and Clio Awards. So yeah, Sindiso, you've got a lot of accolades. I haven't even read all the things that you said, but basically you have a lot of political interests. So you're used to tackling some of Africa's most pressing issues in the form of visual art, and you work with a bunch of different media, pencil, ink, pastels, acrylic, digital media fusion, and you create a subversive street style. And your work has been showcased locally as well as far afield, as New York, London, Berlin, Madrid, Zagreb, Amsterdam, and in some fancy museums, the Vitra Design Museum, the Guggenheim Bilbao Museum, and the Museum of Modern Art in Mexico City. What a man! Proud of you, my friend. You're such a badass. Okay, so now you know his credentials as an artist, which is how he's been well known to the rest of the world. But I know you in the last few years as a father. Tell me about that. When did you become a father? And tell me about your experience of becoming a father. Yeah, I want to hear about that.
Yeah, well, thanks for the intro. It's great to be on the couch. I mean, it's something I joke about it. In fact, no, it's something that I say quite a lot in recent years, is that I'm a full-time dad. And the art gig, that's like my side hustle now. Because I think becoming a dad, I've been a dad for, it'll be five years now, since 2020. Kimani was born in 2020. And I think it's been one of those experiences where I think for the longest time I think for as long as you've known me, I've always been a very nurturing kind of human being. And I think growing up in a family of eight, I have gang, nephews, and nieces. So the nurturing aspect or part of me has always been pretty much in the forefront. So I guess when I had my kid, I was more than ready. Like I had no idea what to expect in terms of what I've actually experienced in the last 5 years now. But at that point, I was ready, you know.
Okay, so can I pause you there? So just tell me, as a man who doesn't have a child, what did you think you were asking for when you said, I want to have a child? What did you think it was going to be like?
To be honest, I thought it was going to be the highlights. Definitely the highlights, you know. I mean, obviously I guess my experience of having kids had been growing up with my nephews and nieces, but I only had them for a very short time. So those are the highlights, you know. I wasn't there when they're up at 2 a.m. and they're screaming their lungs out, and I didn't experience all of that. I experienced the good parts of my nephews and nieces. So I expected that, the highlights. And yeah, it was definitely not that. Definitely not. So I guess I expected the highlight, and obviously from watching your siblings and the way they dad, or the media, how the media portrayed being a father. That's what I expected. But in reality, it's definitely not that at all. Which is not a bad thing. It's not a bad thing at all.
Tell me how the experience was for you. Maybe, just share a little bit about what for you it's looked like to be a father and how that was different from what.
From what I expected, I'd say what it's been—it's almost like a journey that's constantly changing. It's like I can almost see what the destination is, but like I wake up the next day and it's something completely new, completely different. And I think being with a partner who's supportive in that sense has helped shape this journey to be what we had envisioned when we decided, we're gonna go ahead with this, and we're gonna have this with this child, and give it and give him everything that we possibly can, Yeah, it's been quite a journey, like a rocky up and down journey.
So I know you to have had quite a unique experience as a parent, and I know you're keen on sharing that experience. So, I mean, maybe I'll say what I imagine, and then you can tell me how your experience was different. But
I'd
I
like
imagine
to.
that most dads, especially if they have already an existing career, that they're successful, they work hard, their expectation or perhaps the reality of how most dads' lives is, particularly in this country, is they feel that it is enough just to go to work and provide for their families. And it's the expectation across cultures in this country, but all over the world, is that the woman, the mother, is going to be the primary caregiver. She's the default parent. She'll be at home. She'll give up her work. She'll give up her career. And she'll be the one that will be on duty most of the time. And dad will have a role to play, but a lesser role, and he'll kind of come in at the end of the day and kiss his family hello as he enters through the door. And maybe now with modern parenting, he'll probably help with bath time and bedtime, and but that's about it. How was your experience different from that?
So I guess my experience has been different in that I've been very hands-on, very hands-on in the sense that, okay, so basically our setup at home right now is currently I'm the breadwinner. So my wife unfortunately hasn't had much work, in the past, since our money was born. So being the breadwinner, basically I have to keep the lights on. But unfortunately, when Kimani was born, we experienced postpartum depression. And so, which meant that my wife really struggles to be present, particularly for the first 2 years, because the first 2 years were really, really tough. So when we experienced this postpartum depression, it was really hard for her to, I guess, show up in the way that you just explained, that the roles of the mother normally work. So I found myself taking on the role of the primary caregiver, in the sense that because we were dealing with the postpartum, it was really difficult for her to, be there, for example, during the nighttime when the baby wakes up. I had to be the one to get up, go to the cot, bring him to the bed, feed him, all of that stuff, and it was really difficult. Because also we were trying to get to grips with how we can, tackle the depression that we were, experiencing, going through, and also at the same time for me, I need to show up, keep the lights on, bring home the bacon, and also keep my creativity as a, as an art practitioner going. Because I found that when the parenting took over my what I now call my side hustle, art, just took a back seat, like totally. And I speak about the first 2 years because like the first 2 years were the really trying and challenging time, because I think that's how long how long it took for us to sort of get over the depression and everything else that just came with being new parents and figuring it out. And, you know, yeah, it was challenging. And on my part, I think I experienced a lot of weight in the sense that I carried quite a lot during that time. And that was a very character shaping experience, because I was it was almost like I was, you know, like we mentioned before, I had these expectations about being a father, but then when this happened, I didn't foresee that we would experience postpartum depression. Like, it's something that I knew of, but I wasn't really aware of the extremity of this can I say condition.
Yeah.
You know. Yeah. So I guess when we were faced with it, it was really difficult on my part, because it was a very foreign territory for myself, you know. And there really wasn't any room for me to drop the ball, because if I'm being honest, I did also go through some sort of a dip during that time, you know, because of all the pressures. And also it was COVID at the beginning of it, you know, a little bit of uncertainty. I'm also dealing with my ongoing immigration issues, you know, and also just trying to maintain that, as you call it, badass artist side of me that ultimately brings home the bacon, you know. So yeah, particularly the first 2 years were pretty, pretty tough.
Oh no, it's a lot to hold and heavy. And I think what you're saying about being an immigrant as well is that, you know, you're not in your home country, you don't necessarily have a lot of family around you or a lot of support around you. You don't even have the support of your government, right? Like, you're in a foreign country that is, let's be honest, pretty hostile towards you as a Zimbabwean immigrant. So, you know, without support, I mean, I think to a degree, there's almost an unavoidable dip that happens. I think that we actually need to start normalizing the fact that, like, having a baby is such a profound, as you said, character building experience. I think that's a euphemism, really. It's a mind fuck, you know. It's wild. It's a baptism by fire. But we're meant to go through that process with support, with an entire tribe of people around us holding us.
The
village, exactly.
Yeah.
And it sounds like you were very much alone, and maybe because your wife was experiencing her struggles, you were almost meant to be the entire support system for both of you. And that means, who's looking after you? Who's holding you? Who's there, you know, keeping you together? So it's a lot for one person to handle.
No, it was a lot. So, but I mean, with us, so normally in our culture, in both her Zulu culture and also my Ndebele culture, normally in the first 3 months, as soon as the child is born, normally you get support or help from the maternal side of the family. So in this case, she spent some time, well, about 2 months, the first 2 months of Kimani's life was spent at her grandmother's place, where she was raised, where she grew. So those first 2 months were, I can say they helped a lot, in the sense that we were getting to grips, okay, this is, you know, we're getting help from the elders on how to, you know, go about and navigate this new, you know, this new thing of ours. And she was meant to spend 3 months, but after 2 months, she pretty much had got the hang of things, you know. And she didn't feel she needed to, you know, spend another month there. And so she came back home after 2 months. But during those 2 months, so remember, it was during, right in the middle of COVID, So I would wake up in the morning, drive over to her grandma's place where she was staying, and just help out whichever way I could, you know, relearning how to breastfeed, relearning that the baby has this condition, we need to rush into the hospital, you know, all those things have just been the extra set of hands, basically, you know. And because it was during the time when we had curfew, I would be here from the morning until 8, so that I get home just before the 8:30 curfew. And when I get back home, that's when I start my work. So I was burning the midnight oil, you know, just so that was basically my routine. Every day I'd drive, get back home, work, you know, until her grandma decided, oh no, I mean it's fine, I can on some nights I could sleep over, you know, with them. You know, so it didn't mean that I'm rushing to meet the curfew during lockdown. You know. But it was a lot. It was a lot. I was juggling quite a lot, and I think it was almost like I was on overdrive at the beginning because I was just so high on the idea that I have a newborn and I want to show up, you know, and I want to do this thing to the best of my abilities, you know. And I didn't realize that I was actually burning out. Know, I was putting in so much in those first 2 months, and then when we got back home now, that's when, okay, support structure is gone. But I mean, we did have a helper, but she was only with us until a certain time of the day, so like until 4 p.m. So she has to go home because she had her own kids as well. So after the helper's gone, that means it's rock and roll, you know. And because the depression hit us so quickly, you know, like I found myself having to be hands on from very, very early on. You know, and yeah, then so the journey began, and there's a roller coaster after that.
Sure. I
So.
think it's a very unique experience in the sense that, I mean, I obviously speak to a lot of moms who go through depression, but I've never worked with someone where the dad takes on the slack, you know, picks up the slack, because most mothers are just mothering right through the depression, really. But I think that this particular case is specific in the way that she withdrew and how she managed her depression. And it seems like in your dynamic, maybe there was, I don't know, just more interest from your side or more capacity from your side to sort of take on what needed to be done with your child. But I'm curious, what does that mean now for your relationship with your child? Like when you look at other dads, for example, that you know in your cohort, what would you say is the significant difference between your relationship with your son and maybe other dads and how they are with their children or how their children are with them?
I mean, I don't know, because I think if I look at my peers, they look like they're pretty much in the same situation, and that's what the way it looks is that they do have very like strong bonds with their kids, you know. And I think from my experience, and if I'm speaking from my part, our bond was really strengthened during those first 2 years, where he literally saw me as the primary caregiver. You know, he became very attached, which he still sort of, I could say to a large degree, he still is very attached to this day, because something as simple as me going to the grocery store, he's like, he wants to be near me, he wants to come with me, you know. And because I'm constantly traveling, I constantly have to leave the country and whatnot, that's always a very difficult, you know, experience the separation, you know. So I think our relationship was actually cemented and based on like we really, really connected in the sense that I can't even I don't even like these things, but I can't even take a dump. without him sitting right next to me. That's how close, like other attachment is, like, so yeah,
Isn't that the wildest thing, though, when you think about being a parent and you're like, you didn't realize what a privilege it was going to the toilet by yourself?
yeah,
Like,
just
you become a
having that
parent,
time
like,
alone.
oh my goodness, I didn't realize having a shower or going to the toilet by myself was such a privilege.
Yeah, like literally the way we are is like he could follow me around the house. But now he's a bit much older, you know, he can be downstairs doing his drawings and whatnot. But from time to time he'll call out my name, like, Daddy, are you here? You know? And just making sure that I'm around, because I think separation anxiety as well is that he still battles with, because even in times when my wife and I have had to go out on dates or away or to an event, you know, and we obviously can't take him with. And if we're to leave him with a babysitter or take him to his grandparents, for example, it doesn't always go down too well. Like, he will literally, in most cases, he will stay up until we get back home. You know, I know he does that when I go out, like, events as well. If I leave him at home with mom, he most of the time he will stay up till I'm back home, you know. So yeah, we still battle that the separation in that sense.
Yeah, I mean, I think your little family had a really hard start. I think it's been tough. I think that these difficulties have an impact, and it's such a fragile time, those early years. It's such an important time for development, and it sets the stage. So whatever happens in those early years is really, it really has an impact on these little people. But I've met him, and he is the cutest, most okay little kid. I mean, he's okay.
Yeah,
He's
just a moment. I mean, for example, because those first hard those 2 years, so a lot of what my wife would do during, like, coping with medication, she would sleep a lot, she'd spend a lot of time in bed, you know. And I think he got to a point where he associated that with some sort of neglect, because he, to this day, like, if I just close my eyes and take a nap, it rings the alarms and, like, hey, wake up, you can't sleep, you gotta be up. Because I think he gets a bit anxious in the same way. Like, okay, if this guy falls asleep, then who's gonna, you know? But we're no longer there, but I mean, it's kind of like stuck with him in the sense that
Absolutely.
it's
Yeah,
there, it's there.
true. And they do this experiment in psychology called the still face experiment, which is where they take video of a baby and a mother or a caregiver interacting. So you see it like we are seeing it now on Zoom, where there's two videos side by side. And from young, that you if you interact with a baby, their facial expressions mirror yours and you mirror theirs. Like, that's just a natural instinct that human beings have. We'll talk to a baby, and as their eyes will go like this, our eyes will go like this. And this is actually how we build mirror neurons in our brain, and that is what the kind of building blocks of self development is, and attachment. And it's very interesting neuroscience. But the experiment is that they tell the caregiver, they have like a little earpiece, and they say to her, okay, or him, now do a still face where you don't show any expression. And they just go like this. You know, the mother just closes her face up and looks really still and unanimated, makes no sounds, makes no gestures. And you watch on the other screen how the baby responds to that, and they lose their goddamn minds. And this is a minute. The parent is instructed to do this for a minute only, and you watch this baby, how they sort of pull out all their tricks to try and get the response from the caregiver. They'll first start like being cute, and they'll like giggle, and they'll smile, and they'll move their face a lot, and then they'll start get distressed, and they'll start like crying and being like, agitated. And basically, within a minute, they know when you have gone sort of absent. Interpersonally, right? In the space between, intersubjectively. And so to have a depressed mother is a huge interference to that attachment system, because unfortunately, when we are depressed, we do not emote on our faces. And if you're actually sleeping or lying in bed, you are ultimately absent from that intersubjective space with your baby. And all babies really need is that sort of ability to come back to us. That's all they really need. And often, as they get mobile, they'll leave again. They'll go play, they'll do their own thing, but they always come back. And it's often minutes, and they just need to check in. So sometimes just be like, "Hey, look at this." And then you're like, "Yeah, I see it." And then they'll go back to
Very
playing with
true.
their thing. And
Very true.
that's the cycle of attachment. And if that gets interrupted because that person is no longer available, the child really feels it. It's really impactful. So yeah, I mean,
And it's interesting because just last night, when I was putting him to bed, so he does this thing where he stalls a lot. He really struggles with just going to bed generally because he's very active and very playful all the time. So I'm trying to put him to bed. We drew for a bit, because that's part of him stalling. And then we read for a bit. And then I looked at the time, I was like, hey, bro, it's way past your bedtime now. We really have to feed. And so he can feel he's tired himself as well. But then as he's facing me, he's like, I played this game of where I just closed my eyes so that he could just follow through. And he's like, he woke me up quickly. No, don't close your eyes until I close my eyes. So I think the sight of just seeing me asleep and he's awake, I think it's kind of like, it's almost sort of like distress for him. But
yeah.
yeah, it's something as simple as that, like trying to put him to sleep, and he doesn't want me to fall asleep before him, type of thing. So.
Yeah. And sleep is a separation. I mean, we have to, they cotton onto that. And at around this age, I mean, it's very normal really to delay bedtime and everything else, because they really are aware that, sleep is a separation. Mommy and daddy are not going to be with me when I sleep, and I'm missing out also on time with them, right? So as soon as I go to sleep, I'm like, it's over. The play is over. So yeah, I mean, they are tricky. Did you anticipate that being a father would be such a masterclass in emotions? Did you know that you were going to have to get so sort of attuned to another person's emotions?
No, look, I that's the one thing I definitely did not see coming. Like, to be honest, I literally thought it was like this easygoing, let me just show up and be, present and, be that fun, happy, active dad type of thing. Dealing with all sorts of emotions I did not see coming. I think it's also because I also have a weird way of dealing with my own emotions, so it was a double lesson, I guess, in that sense.
Right. That's exactly it. So tell me a bit about that. What did you learn? What is the lesson for you?
I think the biggest takeaway from this has been patience for me. Sort of working in the industry that I've worked in, patience with not being a vehicle, everything is being done so quickly, I need to churn out a machine and stuff. So I think I've being a dad now, I've actually learned that, hey, some of these things take time and you guys just slow it down a bit. And I think getting to patience is like things that I've mastered.
Wow. I mean, I agree with you. I think patience is key. I'm still learning that.
No, I've mastered.
But interestingly, your art, I mean, I have to believe that anyone who's creating art is in touch with the human experience, right? I mean, that's the way it works. You mine from this wealth of experience and feelings that you're connecting to in terms of like your experiences of world events or your own experience. So has your art changed since becoming a father? Like what would you say has happened for you artistically, or in terms of maybe I don't know, what speaks to you in the art world differently than now that since you become a
I
dad?
mean, I think for me, my art, so for mine, it's almost like it's double-sided in the sense that there's the pure artistic side of it and then there's the design. which is what I studied and which is my profession. So with design, normally like you create within a triangle. You know, there's the head, there's the heart, you know, and then there's doing something with your hands. And most of the time as a designer, you create from here first, from the mind first. Whereas being a dad now, I've embraced more creating from the heart. You know, it's like I'll feel something now, like when I'm creating something. I guess my experiences of being a dad and all the emotions that come with that, I've found that the work that I create now comes more from the heart now. That makes sense.
I mean, I think that's super interesting.
Yeah, I think that's the change I've noticed.
Yeah,
and how I used to create before and now.
And so does that then change the output? Like, does it look different on the outside? Does it have different resonance with people? Like, what do you think that has meant for your work?
Yeah, I think it's. Let me think about that first. Because if I think of the work that I've created in the last 5 years, as opposed to the work prior to that, the work prior to that was more, but I guess it comes with growth and, you know, age. It was more like in your face, not really giving a damn, you know, just edgy sort of work. Whereas now I think it's more considered and more. I guess it's softer. My paint strokes have been much softer now. Just before they were much more rigid and edgy and.
That's super interesting. I mean, I think that's really interesting. You know, they've done an amazing study. I mean, I've probably done a few studies on this, but there's like a seminal study where they looked at brains that change, the dads and moms' brains as they change after having a baby. And, you know, it sort of goes against that myth that there's such a thing as a maternal instinct, because they basically show that if fathers have no involvement in their baby's lives and early days, the mother's brain changes significantly after birth. It's a huge, huge change. Like your brain is literally not the same brain after you give birth, whereas dad's brains would pretty much stay the same. But if dads have daily contact with their babies, if their babies are doing skin to skin, if they're changing all the nappies, if they're holding the babies and soothing the babies and regulating the babies with their bodies, the dad's brains actually change significantly as well. And they've done studies now where there's two dads involved, so there's no mom at all, you know, like same-sex partners. And they can see that actually the brain development is really, really significant, and that it changes particular parts of the brain. So testosterone, interestingly enough, goes down. And this makes way for the other hormones, such as oxytocin and those sort of hormones that are more like the caregiving hormones to come into a bigger role. And the brain actually grows, like it develops. There'll be larger activity, greater activity in the areas that are involved in empathy and connection and caretaking abilities and sort of social awareness. So it's really interesting what you're saying. It's almost like your brain has changed as a father, and that it's meant that you actually have softened, and your work sort of speaks to that. You actually have almost become a more, I mean, I don't know what another adjective would be other than soft, but.
Soft. No, I think that's the best word I could come up with, because if I just think about how my work has changed and how my approach to the kind of project that I've been doing has changed, it definitely has taken a much softer approach, a softer route.
I mean, I think the world needs soft men. I think this idea that masculinity is only about hard and powerful and dominance, and you know, that it's such a limiting idea, that actually this idea of soft, vulnerable, nurturing, caregiving masculinity is such a powerful message that we should be embracing, because how wonderful that we get to have more definitions of masculinity, that masculinity can be broadened and widened to encompass more.
Especially coming from where we're from, like on the continent, it's like it's still a very foreign. You know, I mean, for example, I don't know if I mentioned to you, I was traveling to Kenya, the one time, and I went into the bathrooms to change to my new bag and stuff. And the weird looks I was getting from all the other men through that restroom, like, because for me it was like I actually, like, it's almost like I saw nothing completely wrong with me. Like, I didn't even think that, okay, I'm in a place where probably this is still very, but where in my household it's like pretty normal. Like, it's like, oh, you need to be changed, okay, let's do it. So yeah.
Yeah, I think that that is true. I think things are different from what they've been, and that it's not easy to necessarily change, and that there's still enough people that look at you weird if you're a hands-on dad, or you're taking a caregiving role, or you're soft, really, as a man. And that's hard, but that interests me because you also have this kind of political background where you have been using your art as an activist, really, in making political statements. And obviously, we're talking about politics in terms of like the most sort of traditional form of politics, like, national governments and the role of apartheid and these sort of things that you've been thinking about. But I mean, politics could be so many different things. How do you feel like being a dad has maybe shifted your politics, or if you were to do political art now, what are some of the issues that you really feel passionate about as a father, or looking to being like, sending a message to the world? What do you think needs to be said out there? What do you think the messages need to be?
I think, well, for like the first thing that would come to my mind is obviously children's rights. I would find myself more inclined to, addressing those issues. And, with the ongoing stuff that's happening all over the world, in the Middle East and whatnot, out there, I'm more, I think, before, okay, yes, I was fully aware of, the state of affairs and things, what was going on. But I think I'm more drawn to what's happening to the children now, more than anything, because I have that firsthand, experience of what if it was my son going through this? What if this, so I'm more inclined to speak up more for the children now, and that's
Yeah.
basically because of the pressure of being a dad now and understanding that bond and that attachment and that, it's
And how
being a dad.
vulnerable.
Exactly, it's almost like I can be watching, for example, I think I was watching this series called Made on Netflix. Like, I felt myself almost close to tears in a couple of minutes, because I could just relate so much, and understand. I could understand her stress, her distress, and what she's going through. So all of those things just get heightened,
Yeah, that responsibility you feel as a parent.
as
Yeah.
a parent.
And are there any sort of issues or areas in the world right now that you are thinking about in particular when you think about children at risk, or something that you are making art about at the moment, something separate from your design work?
Yeah, funny you mentioned that, because I'm actually meeting with a Palestinian street artist from, what's today, Thursday, tomorrow. He's quite a celebrated photographer and street artist. So we're just gonna get together, and I guess he's in the country. Just want to meet like-minded artists or practitioners in the field of, like, visual art and the like. So I guess definitely there is something that we could tackle,
Yeah.
based on the crisis in Gaza. And I mean, also after my trip to Croatia now, I've also been invited to take part in an exhibition which is called Tolerance. So it's creating artwork around the word tolerance, and depicting that in your vernacular language. So it's like an international exhibition where it asked hundreds of artists from all over the world. So I got the opportunity to be invited to take part in this just
Wow.
after this, this trip, this recent trip to Zagreb. So that's true as well.
Yeah, that's
my headspace is thinking in that direction as well. So how do I depict that?
And does that then feed you? Because I guess you've got your work that feeds the family, but does this other work that is more like the heart stuff, like the political, the activist, the you know, is that stuff, does that also like feed you then as an artist?
I think that's what keeps me sane. You know, amidst all the chaos and responsibility and pressure and whatnot, I think just being able to go back to that, to create for that purpose, it definitely keeps me in a very at peace state. You know, because there's a lot going on there.
Yeah.
A lot. And I wouldn't say that I have vices, but I mean, my coping mechanism has always been, you know, the arts. And
yeah.
it's always a place that I have since I was a kid, not knowing, you know, what it is that I'm, how I'm actually navigating this life thing. But I always found myself going, turning to it. And whether it's in film, whether it's in music, whether it's just the arts, basically, it's always been like a peaceful squat. So actually getting these opportunities and getting to work in spaces like this, like what I've just explained, is definitely something that's good for. Because also, I mean, the stuff that keeps the lights on not fulfilling, if I'm being honest. It looks cool and glossy, all the cool brands to work with and whatnot. But that's basically just for me to be able to provide for my family. It doesn't really feed my soul or inspire to be a better human being. It's more the other stuff.
So it's great that you still have those opportunities to feed your soul then. I'm glad that.
I'm very fortunate to still have those, you know, because these things almost come to me when I'm at my lowest point, you know. And then, an email pops up, or I get contacted by somebody who wants to connect with this thing that I'm passionate about. And I've been very fortunate.
I have one last question for you before we say goodbye. We've spoken about depression and we've spoken about art being what keeps you sane, but have you or your wife sort of accessed any other mental health services over this time that has helped you? Like, what would you sort of say has been helpful to you in dealing with these issues?
So I personally haven't, but she, at some point, it was a struggle at the beginning because we were trying to, you know, figure out how we're going to navigate all of this, you know. But luckily, 2 years back, my wife admitted that she did not need to seek help. So she has been seeing a therapist who's helped, you know, a lot with, you know, unpacking a lot of things that just maybe we weren't aware of, you know, and dealing with a lot of things. I think because it's almost like there's a lot that we need to overcome before we can get to a point where we can, you know, start showing up better for not just the family but for ourselves as well, you know. But as she continues going for her therapy, we've been about for quite some time talking about going to marriage counseling, which is something we didn't do, and we should have done honestly, you know, but we didn't do that because it is life was life for me, and COVID, and the whole of excuses.
Yeah, but I also think just like, we're talking about how, your role as father is almost quite radical in the context of like an African setup. I do think, the idea of mental health and seeking support for mental health is also not necessarily as common or as accepted. In South Africa, we really struggle with that people don't trust the medical system, people don't trust what is really a white Western modality, which is, therapy or psychiatry or whatever else. I mean, I think it's shifting, and thank goodness we've got, a range of different kinds of practitioners, particularly in Joburg where you live. I'm sure there's a lot more Black and
There's quite a mixed diverse, yeah.
psychologists, but it is true that it's kind of a white Western thing. So it can also be that it's just taboo as well. And it's something, and even in white, homes, there's still a hang up from the past of like, seeking therapy is because you're crazy, or seeking therapy is when you have real problems, or, it's like admitting wrong with you, or, and it's hard to then overcome that. It's not ca kind of common that everybody feels comfortable and, accepting of the idea of mental health services. So I think, that's also part of it. But I'm so happy to hear that she has accessed that and that it has helped, because I think for everyone listening, I think it's important, or watching, I think it's important to said sort of really say that we need things like art to save us, and we also need things like medicine and therapy, and that these are all helpful. Thank God for all of them, really.
True, true.
Because this thing that happens to us postpartum, I mean, in some ways it is normal. It's actually common. It's ordinary. But in other ways, it can really be detrimental to your mental health, and needs to be taken seriously as if you were having, as you called it, a condition, but like, a medical condition that needs to be attended to. So I hope that whoever's listening, if any of this resonates with you, that you do know that there are services that you can access that can help you. Cindy, so thank you so much for chatting today. I'm always stoked to see you, and yeah, really, really start
I
up.
know it was long overdue.
Yeah, I know. Maybe we'll chat again another time. I hope you feel better soon. Cindy, such a
I'm built different, so this cold doesn't take me down for too long.
Well, thank you so much for being such a powerful father figure and, role model and family leader. So, being great, friend. Great.
These titles and roles that I'm taking on. The
All right. Take care. Nice to see you.
Thank you so much for listening to On the Couch with Carly. If something in this episode resonated with you or made you feel less alone, that means the world to me. You can find us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and now in video format on YouTube. For exclusive content and resources, visit our website at onthecouchwithcarly.com. If you enjoyed today's conversation, please consider leaving a rating or review. It really does help others discover our safe space for authentic conversation. Until next time, please take good care of yourself. I can't wait to be back on the couch with you again.